Hi, this is comedian Liz Blanc, and you're listening to The Default Setting with Jess Falstick and Gigi Chick, presented by Above Below Entertainment.
Welcome to The Default Setting, where we find out what makes you tick, because we have ways of making you talk. I'm your host, Jess Falstick.
And I'm co-host Gigi Chick.
Today, we have host of the, what is it, the Rooftop Comedy Showcase?
The Locally Sourced
Showcase at the Greenhouse Tavern. It is one of the coolest, most bougie, most packed new shows that are out there right now. Mr. David Horning, hi.
Hello.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. This is awesome.
Your default setting is, what did we say, improv-ing?
I would say yes and.
Yes
anding. My default setting is yes
okay.
and.
Okay. All right. So I assume you've done improv. I think, actually, yes, I remember meeting you now, and you were telling me you started doing improv, correct?
I have, yeah. Okay. Yep. I did it in New York. I was more of a sketch writer, but the second I took improv classes, it like changed the way I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, not only can you yes and with other people on stage and put together a scene, but as a writer, you know, when you sit down and you try to write jokes, you try to write sketches.
I'm just watching his beer.
My beer is just like
slowly starting
bubbling.
To like ejaculate out of the bottle. I'm just watching it slowly. I'm like, this is just a countdown. Do you want me to get some paper towels?
Yes.
Okay.
And.
All right. I'm going to get some paper towels.
Yes, it's
just slowly bubbling over the edge of the bottle, which is actually how I ejaculate, believe it or not. It's very disappointing for the other person most of the time. But
there you go.
Thank you. All right, we've done it. Because when you sit down to write, it's very easy to be like, no, that's a stupid idea. Or like, no, that would never work. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I don't have the means to produce this. Or, you know, that's not going to work for every audience. Rather than just seeing where the idea goes.
Mm-hmm.
And once you do that, I mean, you just kind of free associate and don't stop yourself. And just keep going. Like, even though you might be writing nonsense for 5 minutes, that might spark something that connects the original inspiration for the idea with like where you're actually going to go with it. And I think that's super cool. It's like one of those moments where you just kind of fist pump and you're like, yeah, you know, we're on it.
Oh, yeah.
So you said you were writing before you started doing improv.
Yes. I started as a writer, actually. But then, you know, once you have that moment where you make that connection with audience and other performers on stage, it's like, oh, it's like that drug, you know?
Right.
I mean, I've always loved writing. I've always loved writing and then giving it to other people to produce. Like, I love watching my stuff.
Okay.
Get performed by other people. And, but once you get on stage, man, it's that natural high that just kind of keeps you going. Right. You've been there, you know,
yeah.
I mean, you know how that is.
For sure. What did you start writing? Like, what was your earliest sort of writing stuff?
Jesus. I mean, do we count when I was like 9 writing short stories
sure.
where me and my
Absolutely.
Friends were superheroes
totally.
With ridiculous powers?
Aww.
Like, not even cool superpowers or like the X-Men that they don't talk about in any of the comics, but we still went to the same kind of school.
ice cream scoop man. He can scoop all the ice cream.
No, and God, I hate myself for this, but I did have a character called the Milkman, and...
oh my God, it's all coming back! Oh my God.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was exciting.
No, I do an entire bit based around milk, and anyway, but this character, all he could do was turn into milk, but he couldn't do anything once he became a puddle of milk, so there was always just randomly a puddle
of milk. It was just a cool party trick, basically.
Yeah, yeah, like he would, you'd be at the warehouse, like the secret lair of the supervillain, and there's just, they're like, why is this puddle of milk on the ground? And then when they try to sweep it up, he's like, no, no, he always got captured. He was of no use. He was of no use.
Did people cry over it?
I never killed him off. Yeah. I never killed him off. I don't know. I used to read that my teachers, for whatever reason, let me read these stories out loud to the class. And I think that was my first taste of like being able to make people laugh.
That's good. I mean, you got that kind of good feedback. I went to this weird rural school where everybody was extremely judgy and had no imagination. So I'm glad that people were supportive.
Yeah, I was insane. I went to a Catholic school. So you would think that they'd be like...
No, they get told imaginary stories all the time.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. We're going to go there. Slippery slope right from the start. Man, you went there.
I did go there. That was the least controversial thing that's happened on the show so far.
Right. Oh, we are off to a running start. But no, that's really where my love of writing and making people laugh started. And then, like, me and my one buddy would write parodies of Limp Bizkit songs and perform them for our religion class.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they were so bad.
Please enlighten.
For
please,
religion
please,
class?
Oh, man. Please.
Let's see. Instead of break stuff, we had pray stuff. No, it didn't. They weren't good. I mean, I was 12, you know? I mean, they were as good as a 12-year-old with
give me something to pray. Did you guys use those words?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Are you kidding? Yeah, we had to.
There it is.
And then,
what about Nookie?
Nookie.
Did you guys do Nookie?
Yeah, but it didn't rhyme. We did it all for the parish. So you can take that money and stick it in the basket. Like, it was so dumb. But I mean, it doesn't take much to get a 12-year-old to laugh.
That's so
incredible.
Good.
So that was my first
captive audience. so that was fun. And then, like, I was in musicals and stuff in high school.
Okay.
And I would Fiddler always write Earth. A... That was eighth grade.
Okay.
But yeah, and I would write a little parody of each one. And
really? Just for fun?
Yeah, just for fun. And then during rehearsal, when, you know, we weren't being used, we'd be backstage and like a group of people would sit around, myself and my one buddy, Tim, and we'd maybe involve like one or two other people, depending on how many characters were in the scene that we were riffing on. And because I'm very heavily influenced by movies like Airplane and like Scary Movie and Monty Python and
Goofy.
I love those slapstick. Those are the movies that really got me excited about comedy and like making people laugh. Because I mean,
so when you were writing, was it from your perspective more of just like fun way to pass the time and occupy your mind? It wasn't for anything specifically.
Right.
Yeah,
that's how it started. It was fun and to be able to make people laugh, like that's always.
And it sounds like you had other friends that were interested in that as well, which I think is kind of rare. I don't know, like at least at that age.
Well, I included them too. You know, I you know, if they had any ideas, because I mean, sometimes I would get writer's block and I'd be like, I don't know what to do here, and they'd be like, oh, it'd be funny if XYZ happened. Mm. I wrote. The only screenplay I've ever written was 102 pages. I was a sophomore in high school, and it was a parody of The Fellowship of the Ring.
Okay.
And there was a love triangle between Gandalf, Aragorn, and Frodo.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam was always the odd one out. And, of course, at the end of Fellowship, they get stuck together. And so then I never got to the Two Towers because like I feel like one is enough. Especially when you're 16 and you're trying to balance like working at a grocery store. And then,
you're like, we'll just stop it there.
Yeah. This is fine. We're good
just
here.
Cut this off.
We're good here. But then I stopped for a while.
Yeah.
You know, I went to college and I did the whole, you know, that's not a realistic way to make a living.
Mm.
You know, I've got to, you know, so I went to Kent State for a couple of years. I did journalism there. And the first thing you learn, which bothered me from the jump, if it bleeds, it leads. So essentially, the more sensational and emotionally captivating you can make a story, the higher up on the front page of the news it's going to be.
Mm.
And that bothered me because, you know, when you look at the newspaper, it's all the terrible stuff that's happening. And you go to the back and it's like, oh, by the way, like we found a way to teleport a light photon, you know, several miles. It's like, I think that's cooler because that's something that we can really use and actually like get excited about and inspire kids to like get into science. While in the meantime, we're talking about, you know, what's going on.
I think that's the frustration I have in general with current social media is just the tedium in which that all that stuff just sort of rises to the top as far as, you know, and I think there's a sort of self-awareness and loathing in a lot of us because of it. But like, it's, I mean, I have it like all the time. I'm just like, oh, the Kardashians are modeling Fendi. And I like click on that link because I want to fucking see it. And I don't know why. And in my head, I'm like, God damn it, just go read about fucking like meteors or something.
Right.
Like, go do something else. And I'm just as interested in that shit because I'll click on it. But like, I guess it's probably okay to have that balance. But at the same time, I get your point. Like, it sucks that like human beings have evolved to get
You've
more interested in like
before,
aesthetically
as a consumer.
Dynamic. You know what I mean? Like attention grabbing things. I don't know.
Right. And it's so easy to do. I get sucked in the same black hole. But I mean, that's kind of how we're biologically built. Like, you know, fight or flight. You know, you see something that triggers an emotion and you follow that because, you know, I might die, even though that's completely like, irrational to think that way. You know, yeah, that emotion gets triggered. And here
so
we
you
are.
Kind of got sort of cynical based on the stuff that journalism wanted to focus on because you felt it was less important or less, you know, critical than
that and I didn't have the creative freedom that I wanted as far as a writer. When I feel like there are walls that I have to write within, like a silo I have to write within, it kind of stifles my creativity because I start thinking, no, I can't write that because that doesn't go along with the formula. And like, I had a teacher in high school who would subjectively grade my stuff. Like she would give me points for grammar, but you know, she didn't like my ideas, and you know, she would take points off for that. Like it was a creative writing class, and there was this, we had a project that we had to do. It was, you know, there was these little pastel or like watercolor paintings, and we would have to write you could write anything. It could be poetry, it could be a short story. So I set up this beautiful scene, you know, I painted the picture with the words. It was this little thatched roof cottage village. And in the background, it looked like a tidal wave. So I set up this beautiful scene, and then it just came crashing down, the one line. And then everyone was killed in an instant by this tidal wave.
Yeah.
And, you know, she just kind of gave me that look as I was reading it out loud to the class. I got a C on it. But yeah, no. So
it's like the Fountainhead, like, yeah, like the whole shit about like stifling creativity and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
that's funny.
So I went from that, and I did political science because I was like, oh, I'm going to make a difference in the world. And
this is literally what Ryan DePerna did. He started journalism and poli sci at Kent State. Yeah, he was just talking about this. Yeah,
we could have some good conversations.
Yeah,
then, for sure.
Yeah.
No, I transferred to Akron and did political science there. And then there was another thing that bothered me there. I took it was a class on political parties, and one of the classes, the professor was like, "All right, conservatives in the room, shout out whatever word you think of when you think of liberals." And it was like, tree hugging hippies. Like, they didn't use snowflake at the time, but it was like, you know, soft or whatever. Mm. And then they did the same thing. You know, liberals, what do you think of Republicans? Like Bible thumpers,
rednecks,
racist, redneck NASCAR. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, no wonder we can't get anything done if the first thing that we think of when we see somebody doesn't agree with us is like this negative thing.
Yeah.
No wonder we can't come together. So I was like, okay. So that's when I realized that politics is about politics and like winning and being right rather
than on a team.
Right. Exactly.
I mean, I don't know if you've, I mean, I'm guessing you've probably taken a pretty deep interest in just the current, you know, environment of things, because that's when it's all started slowly occurring to me that like, oh, it doesn't matter what this person does. Like, he can fucking, like, you know, he can say anything, and like his supporters will just be like, yes, absolutely, whatever. And then you just realize, like, it's just about team loyalty. It doesn't have anything to do with the person or what they believe, or like, and it's nuts to me that like people's ideals can be so easily, you know, their morals can be so easily like swayed by the idea that like, as long as the Republicans are winning, as long as the Democrats are winning, because that's the problem I think that's been with Cleveland for a really long time. People just straight up vote party line Democrat, and they've been doing it for decades. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason our infrastructure is falling apart, and we have an opioid crisis, and we have 100 other things that we need to focus on, but instead we keep fucking renovating stadiums for sports teams where the only player who's decent keeps leaving. And, you know, I mean, it's just, it's a lot. Like, it's a lot of...
You just reminded me of some YouTube video. I don't know. It was like, I don't know if it was Jimmy Kimmel or something like along those lines, where he sent someone out into the streets and they would quote some type of like political phrase to them, some like theory. And they'd be like, so, you know, Trump said this, do you agree with him? And they'd be like, then he would say like, when Trump said this and say a line, they would be like, yep, I completely agree and all this stuff. And he was quoting Hitler, Stalin, all these people. They had no idea that Trump hadn't said these things. And it's like, to me, I was like, that's
troubling.
That proves it right there.
That's really troubling.
That is straight up troubling.
It's just the person and not the actual ideals and the, like, what do you actually believe, you know?
Bill Squire has the best joke about, he's like, I just wish people weren't, like, politics wasn't such, because that's the thing, like, we're pretty fucking loyal to sports teams here too, but I think politics is even deeper, which it should be. But the thing that I think is really funny is he has this joke about, like, my friends and I can still be friends if, like, someone likes lacrosse. Like, and I'm not like, fuck you and your fucking lacrosse and your fucking highlight sticks and, like, you know, and then anybody has any sort of expression of, like, well, I think, you know, unions should probably be, like, you know, everyone's like, oh, fuck you, I don't want to hear. Like, it's just crazy how it's embedded into these like weird emotions that we all have of like questioning our core beliefs when it talks about politics.
For sure. And I mean, it's so much about politics, so much about being right. Like when you have it's a disparate number of politicians have gone to law school. What do you learn in law school? How to win.
Yeah.
And how to prove the other side wrong. Mm. So when that is your default setting, in this case, as a politician,
I'm never wrong.
Yeah. It bleeds down into the electorate too. It bleeds down into, you know, your constituents.
Yeah, it's like, I'll convince you that the other people are wrong.
Right. Right. And it's such an amazing experiment in human behavior.
I think it almost kind of gives way to the idea that like, a lot of people just want to be lemmings. They just want to follow. They want to be told what to believe. They want to be told what to think. It's just, you have to be on the right team for them to be open to hearing it. You know what I mean? Because I honestly believe if tomorrow Trump came out and was like, you know what? We should just make healthcare available for everybody. Fuck all this Obamacare repeal. Like the Republicans would be like, yes, no, this makes perfect sense. Like even people have been rallying against it for decades would just be like, yay, absolutely, good job. I mean, there's nothing he could say at this point. Like gay marriage should be like legal in all the countries. They'd be like, yay, hooray, that's what Jesus said too. Like they would make excuses.
Well, I mean, he said he could like, what was the quote? He said he could shoot someone. I don't know.
I know what you're talking about.
It was during election. He was campaigning, and he was like, oh, yeah, I could shoot someone in like the middle of New Orleans during Mardi Gras, and like no one would even touch me.
Something like that.
And then, you know, and then literally if, you know, fucking Bernie Sanders was saying the same thing, they'd be like, oh, fuck that guy. You should go to jail, too. And, you know, make up stupid, weird-ass reasons.
No, it's such a fun microcosm of like I said, like human behavior. I mean, it's not about like the people involved in politics are people. So at the core, this is a human behavior issue rather than a political issue. I mean, if you really want to get nitty gritty with it, I mean, it's, you know, like you said, people want to be lemmings. It's easier that way.
Do you find it frustrating though that people are so willing to be, first of all, followers, and second of all, not aware of that? Because it seems like if most people were aware, if they were like, oh fuck, I'm following the group, they'd be like, oh, I can't. Because you call someone a lemming, they don't want to be a lemming. They don't want to think that they're a follower, even though they fucking are.
Of course not.
So is it frustrating, number one, that they are, and number two, that they don't seem to have any awareness of that fact?
It is frustrating, but at the same time, like, that's why I love comedy, is if you can get somebody to laugh at the exact thing that they're doing, you've made a connection with that person, where subconsciously they're saying, oh, that's me, I haven't looked at it that way before. That's what I love about you know, comedy in general, is if you can do that, you've got them to, even if they don't realize they're thinking it, like.
We're just talking about that. Yeah. Yep, absolutely. And like, you can use comedy to diffuse in a lot of ways, but you have to be very crafty about it. Like you have to make sure that like what you're doing has been well honed and fine tuned and tried out before. Like, cause that's it. You just go in with guns blazing about one side or the other, and you're going to alienate most of the audience right away. And versus like, you can tell a joke that was well written and both people from both sides can laugh about it. That's good.
Absolutely. It's interesting too. I do now. Skipping a few chapters
we go back and forth all the time.
Today, right?
Totally fine.
But I've become a motivational speaker because I love the way I love learning about people. I love, you know, like human behavior. I read a lot about psychology and you see it all the time. And comedy is just like pointing out these errors in human thinking. Mm. And so what I do is I go to HR groups because I want people to be happy about their work. I want them to be excited about what they do, engaged in what they do, because, I mean, we take our work home with us.
Yeah.
Whether we want to admit it or not, if we're not happy with our jobs, if we're not happy with what we're doing, you know, we're not going to be happy in general. And like, even though we live in a world where we can get information instantly, we live in a world where, you know, more people are driving than ever before, more people are going to college than ever before, yet our happiness levels have remained the same. Like when you look at workplace statistics, a lot of people are not engaged by their work. So that's why I do it. So I'll go to these HR groups and I use characters. I use some of my stand-up bits to make these people laugh, and again engage that part of their brain. It's like, oh, I guess I do that kind of. And sometimes I get met with resistance, like, oh, you haven't been in this situation before. You don't work in HR. It's not about working in HR. Just like it's not about politics. It's about human behavior and like how you perceive things and perception, and perspective, and So, I mean, there is a lot of kickback from that. And it's frustrating to get because I did a presentation in Minnesota in January. And
of all the places.
Well, if you're going to go to Minnesota, January. You better go to Minnesota, the most Minnesota time of year. And that is January when it is -7 degrees.
Minnesota, you in the face.
Yeah. And you know, walk outside and get punched in the face with the temperature. Well, it's like, all right, got to lean into it, man.
Yep.
But this presentation, I got an email a week after the presentation from a guy that was like, everybody in our group was offended by your presentation.
And what'd you do?
I did the same presentation I do all the time. And I also got an email like a couple days after the presentation by a woman who was like, we want to book you. We thought what you had to say was great.
Oh, so
it was
wow.
the same presentation. And
Interpreted by two different groups.
Right. And the guy that sent me that email, I mean, I sent him an email back just like, thank you for the feedback, you know, because everybody has their own perspective of it. Yeah. And I'm not going to attack your perspective because that's the opposite of what I'm trying to say. And, you know, I sent an email back, you know, thank you for the feedback. Yeah. If there's anything more specific, like, you know, I can do because I want to make people happy. And if I didn't, then I'm not doing my job. But it's just funny that two people saw the exact same presentation and had two completely different perspectives of it. And this guy, I mean, he was older, so he'd been, you know, in the field for a long time doing the same thing.
I wonder if that's just like it's inevitable, because like there's all this stuff like people give old people a lot of shit for. One of them's being closed-minded, but I think we're all gonna be in some way. Like we're not gonna be racist, we're not gonna be homophobic. We're gonna probably be like we'll probably use gender-specific pronouns, and our grandchildren will be appalled or something. Yeah. But like the other thing is like old people are mad and like angry, and like just wonder if we're gonna be mad and angry just because everything hurts and. There's a war and
right.
I don't know. Like there's gotta be reasons. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, was that your experience? Just like he was kind of more closed-minded to what you were having to say because of his age or.
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. Like, I mean, there can be people who are younger. I gave a presentation in Maine a few weeks ago. It was for like 20 some people and I didn't get very many laughs. Mm. You know, the jokes that always land didn't. And the very next day, gave the same presentation. I always record my presentation so I can go back and see like what worked, what didn't. I didn't really make any changes because the next, I mean, it was within 24 hours. Yeah. It was like a 1 o'clock presentation the one day, and then the next day it was an 8 a.m. presentation. Mm-hmm. And the next day, it was a group of 70 people and killed. Same exact joke, same exact delivery.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't change anything up.
That's comedy, man.
Yeah. Right? I mean, you read the room. So it really depends on...
Subjective.
Yeah, it's very subjective, which is the beauty of it, man. If everybody had the same perspective, how boring would life be?
Sure.
But no,
make comedy
I think,
easier, though.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Like, oh, this will just land every time, and no one will ever not laugh at this.
Oh, I know. You know, you don't get better that way.
Yeah.
You gotta yes and with the audience, you know. Mm-hmm. You're gonna say, okay, well, that didn't work. Cool. Mm-hmm. I'm going to keep going, and then we'll see what happens.
Were you going to say something, Jeej? Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I just had like a, when you said, or it'd be, you know, like it'd be easy to do comedy. I'm like, or would it be hard? Because everyone, like there'd be such competition.
Oh, because everybody's funny.
Like you
all
could
the
never
time.
Make it.
Yeah.
Everyone's just like ha 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 ha.
Everyone's like constantly just like ha ha, and you're like, okay, well, but they're like, no, everyone's this good. You can't go anywhere.
All right, so you did Poli Sci.
I did Poli Sci.
And you were still just writing at this point?
Not really.
Okay.
But then one of my close friends from childhood. I mean, we're still best friends. He decided to move to New York to pursue acting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was in a weird place at the time. I was like, well, you know, I'm not enjoying this. I'm not enjoying political science. I don't know what I'm going to do. Like, it doesn't make sense to do something I don't love to do. And, I mean, it was a rough period in my life. Like I got a DUI.
I think everyone has gotten a DUI. It's like a rite of passage, yeah.
I was like, okay, so I'm an adult now.
Yeah.
Welcome.
No
one threw me a party, though.
No.
It wasn't like a bar mitzvah.
No.
I thought I would get a better reaction from my family. But so that happened. My aunt was actually murdered.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Curveball there. A little swerve.
Holy shit.
And I think this is where I realized that I need to go back to making people laugh.
Yeah.
Because not only was she murdered, but she was murdered by somebody that was hired by her daughter. And so, yeah. It was a tough few weeks. Oh, they did a show, an episode of Snapped about it too.
What?
Long story short, that happened, and I remember I was at the wake, and you know, she wasn't technically my aunt, but she was my aunt. I mean, she was like very close.
Aunt.
I mean, she was my dad's first cousin.
Gotcha.
And she was like, because all of my actual aunts and uncles live all over the country.
Gotcha.
And so she kind of just like took on that role. She was always at my musicals and like any of my events and my brother's stuff. So she took on that role really well. And she was somebody that she never really thought of herself. It was always about other people. It was always about her daughter. It was always about, you know, us. She always brought stuff over. She was always there to support us. And but she liked making people happy.
Yeah.
And so when I was at the funeral, like, I noticed nobody was happy, and everybody was, you know, talking about how tragic it was. And I thought, you know, she wouldn't like this.
Yeah.
But then that's when I realized that the first three letters in funeral are fun. And so I thought that was pretty ironic. And I thought, well, if I could make this funeral fun, like, what would I do? Well, being like 22, I was like, oh man, you know, we'd have
can't spell cake, slaughter without
yeah.
laughter.
Yeah. I haven't heard that one before.
Sorry. Too soon. My bad.
No. Because I've turned this whole thing into a joke because, I mean, it happened. Once I was ready to kind of see it from a different point of view, I did. And then I started sharing that with other people. I was like, you know, come down to the Horning Home for Funerals where you where you take the scary out of the berry and put the fun in your funeral. I had like different themed funerals. You can have the four weddings in a funeral where we book four weddings in the exact same room at the exact same time as your loved ones. Like, turn it into a going away
party.
So
wait, what did you do this in?
So I shared this with some of my friends and some of my family. And to be able to, like, break that tension with something so silly.
Did it help?
Well, I got a lot of, David, you're crazy.
Yeah.
But it kind of broke the ice a little bit. Because for the 2 weeks between the actual murder happening and, like, the wake, it was just one note, man. I mean, it's tough.
And it is, I mean, like, that's a really fucking tragic thing. So for the fact that, like, I think it was ballsy, you know what I mean? Or you at least knew that your family would be amenable to...
Yeah, they're good sports.
Yeah, I don't know, like, my family's so, like, opposite end. Like, some of them would be cool, and the others would be, like, appalled if I tried to do stuff like that.
Yeah,
so.
I remember my brother was like, that's fucked up.
but then, it's kind of what we've been talking about, like, that's what ends up being funny, which is why edgelords are a thing, because they're always trying to shock people, but they can't do it in a way that's, like, tactful or constructive, and, I mean... Just it's what's funny is provocative and maybe even too soon or maybe even like inappropriate, but in a, you know,
there was a guy even like walking around my cousin's funeral like last year and he was smiling like kind of like a lot and we weren't really sure why and he was freaking us all out and I seriously thought my aunt was going to kill him like
because it was her
in
son
the funeral home. No, it wasn't even, it was just like her nephew.
Okay.
And we were all looking at him, and she was just like, why is he smiling? Stop fucking smiling! Like, it's like you're not allowed to smile. Yeah. But he was, like, creepily smiling, too. It wasn't just like, hi. Yeah. He was just walking around like, I'm on drugs.
Everybody deals, you know, with this thing that happens to everybody in a different way. And that's a good point. You know, he's walking around with a smile on his face. Maybe it's just like the
I mean,
only
it made us super uncomfortable.
Right.
But yeah.
Right. I mean, in a situation like that, you're not always like, how is everybody else going to perceive me right now?
Right.
And I don't know. It was like that moment where I was like, oh, I was able to make people smile in this situation. Maybe I should go back to trying to make people laugh.
Yeah.
A couple of years later, you know, I had this intention. So I went through my last 2 years of college knowing that, you know, I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to write sketch comedy because I loved SNL. I love, you know, sketches. I wrote a pretty bad pilot for a pilot contest. But there were some really good jokes in it that, like, you know, when people read it, made people laugh. And then we did this Friendsgiving every year. It was me and my lunch table from high school.
Aww.
Every year. We still do it, actually, which is awesome. But for a couple of years, I would put together a PowerPoint presentation and just, like, Photoshop their faces onto, like, animated bodies and like, the story of the first Thanksgiving. Just dumb stuff that, you know, it was my stage at the time. I was like, holy shit, I love this. I get off on the fact that I can, you know, have that instant reaction from other people.
Yeah.
Just like make that instant emotional connection. So I went to New York. I did sketch writing at UCB.
Okay.
And that was awesome. That taught me so much. It allowed me to hone it. So whereas before I was just trying to make people laugh, now I start realizing that, you know, you can write a silly sketch, but it's so much better if you're trying to say something with that sketch.
Okay.
And that has really helped me with my writing as far as like, I don't like to write anything that doesn't have an underlying message that I'm trying to get
across.
I don't punch people in the face with it. Honestly, my underlying message for everything is just like, take a step back and see things a little bit differently. Like use perspective. I mean, that's really what comedy is. But just also like accept things happen. If we accept those as just an objective truth and add something to it. Mm-hmm. And that's where improv is so powerful, is it's not just, you know, building a scene on stage. It's taking something like, you know, my aunt dying and seeing that you can add something to it. Like, here's the truth. Here's what happened. Here's where we are. Here's what we know. Now I can add something to it to, elicit a reaction, make it goofy, make somebody smile, get myself through a tough situation. And I think if more people behaved like that, you know, that was their first instinct, rather than say, no, you're wrong. I think we'd create, be more able to come together and create a lot more. Right. Yeah. Exactly. I mean,
When you were running at UCB, and I don't really know much about UCB. I'd like to know more. Mm-hmm. When you write, does that go hand in hand with like an improv program, or is that sort of separate, or how did that all?
It's separate. Okay. It's separate. Actually, my first improv class out there that I took was at the Pit, the People's Improv Theater.
Okay.
And it was a character improv class because I was so bad at writing characters. Like, I would come up with premises like this, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I was always, you know, coming up with the next idea for a premise, but then I'd sit down to write it, and characters would act like robotic, and people don't talk like that. Like,
sure.
So I took a character improv course, and that was, I'll never forget the class, because the core thing that she taught was, if that's true, then what else? So if you see somebody do something, rather than like, imagine that they just do that one thing all the time. Like, if this person gets so angry about a little, like, you charged me $1.99 twice for that item, you know, at the grocery store. If they get real worked up about that, then what else do they do?
Okay.
And so that really got me interested in people. And that's what really got me. I started reading books on like psychology and human behavior. Mm. And that's where the motivational speaking kind of came into play. But I think improv really helped with my sketch, because I was able to write realistic characters, and like, they get put in events and, you know, have to deal with it. Like, what do I want? What do I do to get it? What's getting in my way? How do I respond to that?
So you wrote, sketches, or you learned how to write sketches at UCB,
mm-hmm.
and then you you performed improv with People's Improv Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I took a couple classes at UCB. It was like one-off classes as far as improv, but it was really the sketch that got me going, because it being able to sit at a table of people and take an idea that might suck at first and turn it into gold just by accepting each other's ideas and adding to them. I mean, because it's so easy to just be like, you're wrong, my way is right.
Yeah.
That doesn't get us anywhere.
Yeah.
But if whether it's a good idea or not, if you say, hey, I accept that you came to me with this idea, here's what I would add to it.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, I mean, if it's a bad idea, maybe they were grasping at straws or like struggling to come up with the idea to begin with, if you give them something that might spark like a creative muscle, like, oh my God, this is where the sketch is going.
Right.
I mean, I've written a lot of sketches that sucked at first, that with the help of a table of people working together to help me create something, it turned into really good sketches. And I actually UCB has a whole system where, you know, you get on the sketch teams and you kind of progress through it. There's like a natural like hierarchy promotion.
Mm.
I like that, but again, it goes back to not liking, like, being uncomfortable with having to fit into a certain structure. So what I did, I worked at a comedy club, and there were a couple guys that worked there who were also sketch writers that were talking about, you know, we want to do a sketch show here.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, awesome. They came to me, you know, we want you to write for it, you know, help us write for it. So I was in. But 2 months went by and nothing happened. Like, we would sit down and have conversations and be like, oh yeah, we're going to talk to the booker tomorrow. And it was always, we're going to talk to the booker tomorrow. We're going to talk to him tomorrow. We're going to talk to him tomorrow. So I was like, fuck it, you guys, I'm going to talk to him tomorrow and we're going to get this thing going. And I did. And we ended up, we brought in a cast of people from UCB, like 8 cast members. We brought in 6 other writers, no, 6 other writers. There were 7 of us. And we put on a show, and like, we sold out the first show.
Oh, wow.
It was crazy. And it was really, really good. It was like objectively funny sketches. And the same thing, like all the ideas that we had the first pitch meeting were not fleshed out. We had no idea what we were doing, but just those ideas bouncing off of each other and saying, you know, support that supportive environment. Like, I think everybody should take improv.
Right.
Oh yeah.
I think that would do humanity a lot of good. And I actually include a little improv exercise at the end of all my presentations, just like to help people get a different perspective of people. It's pretty widely used. It's called the ad game. Basically you create a product, you base it off of like an everyday household product, but it's an everyday household product that does something that no other product like that does. So like it's an oscillating fan that plays music or something. And there's different prompts. And the two rules, the first rule is the first idea that someone shouts out, best idea. Second rule is everybody in the audience is tasked with like letting that person know that we agree it's the best idea. Like, we're so excited that you came up with that idea. Mm-hmm. That idea. Because what that does, like, people don't want to come there. People are self-conscious about their ideas. Like, what if it's a bad idea? What if they hate it? So when you accept it and then support that idea, that gets everybody else in the room excited to share their idea as the product builds. And then create just a short little ad campaign about it, like a slogan and a jingle. And it's funny how at first people are like, I don't want to say anything. And then you start like supporting their ideas and they're like, oh my God, here's my idea. So it's super cool to watch.
It's funny that you're talking about this because I was literally just listening to a really old, this is my catchphrase. I was listening to This American Life and they were doing a study. It's like the one bad apple theory and like group work together and whether like one really negative person can fuck up everybody else. And they were actually saying that in most scenarios they hired an actor and he came in and he would be one of three people. He would be an asshole. He would be the depressive pessimist where it was just like, what's the point in any of this? This is all boring. Like, you know, like that guy. Or the slacker. And so they'd have him like talking, like texting with people, and then he'd like break out a sandwich and just start eating it. And
every group project has one.
Yeah, you know, they're trying to see like how this affected the rest of the group. And they said in most scenarios where this guy showed up, if he was a jerk, everybody started fighting each other. If he was a slacker, everybody just started going, man, fuck it. Like, there's, you know, no point. The depressive pessimist, so everybody else was like, let's just get this over with. Like, no one wanted to do a good job. They just wanted to get it over with. But then they said in the rare occasion where he didn't affect the group, there'd be someone who was like, he actually said the one most successful group he was in, because the guy that was in the group was like the son of a diplomat from like South America somewhere. And he just had it in his blood to be able to like diffuse and get everybody like refocused back on the topic. And I don't know if that's anything you've noticed in like a lot of the stuff that you do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My second UCB writing class I had, I feel like the teacher wasn't as supportive with ideas. So sometimes it would derail good stuff. But what we did, independently, the whole class met outside of the actual class. On the weekend, we'd go to the basement of this restaurant that one of the other writers worked at, and we'd like work on our sketches together. And it was much more supportive, and we'd get to the class, and you know, he'd be a lot more receptive to it. But at first, you know, you come up with an idea, he'd be like, yeah, but you know, I don't know if that would work in this way, maybe it would work better in this way, rather than being like super open to it. And we've all worked with that person that's just like
oh yeah,
yeah, it's
just takes everyone down, their energy just is like sucks the energy out of you.
You walk in and you're like, yeah, like today's gonna be a great day, and then you see them, they're like, fuck everything. Ugh. Oh no,
that's the worst.
That's one of the reasons I had to like, I'm I'll post stuff to Twitter, but I don't read Twitter anymore, because it's just a hysteria factory of nonstop, just like everything is terrible. And then it was funny because a lot of that's died down. It was real bad like around last fall. And then I remember right after Star Wars came out, everyone was like, Star Wars is terrible. I'm like, well, clearly not everything is terrible if you have the affordability to be able to bitch about fucking Star Wars. Right. Like, right. Put that in perspective. So
yeah. It's so interesting. Actually, there's a case study that I love. It's called the Lozada line, the Lozada ratio. But he's a behaviorist and a mathematician, and he was brought in with a positive psychologist to this Chilean mining company. and they were experiencing like
they get trapped in a cave.
They didn't. Okay. I know that's very topical now. Yeah, no. Sorry. You thought it was gonna go there.
No, I did. Sorry.
Twist. It doesn't.
What a twist.
Plot twist.
Ooh. And so this company is not doing well. Like people are backstabbing each other, undercutting each other, always trying to be right. You know, and so he did like a behavioral study. Found that for every one positive interaction, there was 1.16 negative interactions. So they basically evened each other out. So what he found, he instituted some new policies on how people should behave around each other. And it was just simple things like, you know, if you come within 5 feet of somebody that, in the office, you smile. Or if you come within 10 feet, you smile. If you come within 5 feet, you smile say and hi. Say hi. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's just like simple behaviors like that, that subconsciously communicate to one another, like this person is on your side, that help. And when they raised that ratio from like 1.161 to, no, it was 1.561, and then 3.16, so every 3.16 positive interactions to every one negative interaction, this company just started flourishing. Like wow. They experienced like 40% growth. Yeah, it was insane.
That's crazy.
It's insane. It's just those little things, like supporting each other. And now to say, so like get rid of all negative interaction, like we're humans, that's part of life. You need to be able to take something and be like, "Ah, this is wrong," but or like, and we can do something about it.
Yeah,
and it's that mentality when you know that people are on your side. Like,
oh yeah,
you know, see a problem. That's what it is. Here's where we are. What can we do together to fix it?
Yeah. So you're interesting just because I have friends that are in improv, and anyone who's tried to cross the bridge into stand up hasn't really wanted to keep doing it. I think to that point, there's a natural optimism built into improv of like, yes, and like everyone I know, I laugh about this. I probably even told this story. I think I literally told this story recently on the podcast. One of my best friends does improv. I'll try to summarize this as best I can for everyone who's already heard this fucking story. they were doing lip sync battle at Hilarities one night, like she and her whole improv troupe. And we won like two pitchers of beer, and they brought over two pitchers for us and a bunch of glasses, and she started pouring everyone glasses of beer. And I'm sitting over here, all her other friends are sitting on the other side, and all of a sudden I see her slowly start to pour the glasses back into the pitchers. And I'm like, what happened? And she was like, well, I forgot that Jenny is only 20. And I was like, oh. And she was like, yeah, no. I was like, Jenny, it's okay. Like, no one cares. Like, it's, you're 20. And like one of her other improv friends was like, don't pressure her, Erin. Like, and I'm like, you people are the most goody two shoes after school. But like improv people are like the glee club of comedy. Like they're so, and I think they immediately get dissuaded by how cynical and negative and sort of dark stand-up comics can be. So I think it probably takes someone extremely well adjusted to just say like, oh, these are just, you know what I mean? It's from your perspective talking about like, we're just meat-covered skeletons with, you know, like...
That's my favorite.
Yeah, like, brains that just, you know, operate like glorified monkeys. Like, I mean, you know, like, we just don't... it takes a certain kind of, like, patience, I think, with humans to be able to be like, it's just fucking people. Like, and you don't take it personally, and you don't think... You know what I mean? Like...
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that's something you possess?
I'm lucky because I took an interest in human behavior. Yeah. So, you know, it... Coming into an open mic where 50% of the jokes are super dark because
edgelords are there,
right,
or wannabe edgelords, yeah.
I can see where they're coming from. I can see what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
I that's not my personal style, but there's a time and a place for it. It's just sometimes, you know, trying to force it doesn't. It's hard to create the time and the place when you're with a room full of people who are resistant to it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll sit in the back of an open mic and I'll write down notes. Like if somebody has a good idea but they don't execute,
yeah,
you know, like a punchline,
mm-hmm.
I'll write down like what I would do differently.
Yeah, yeah.
I won't just like go up to people and be like,
people
hey,
don't
want to
hear that
better.
Shit. Yeah, people don't want to hear that shit.
No. But I mean, if like I've developed a relationship with a couple of comedians who are kind of starting out here, and like I just like to share ideas,
yeah,
and then take it if you want, if not, you know, throw it out, whatever. But it makes going to mics a lot more engaging for me, and it makes, you know, watching people try to be edgy a lot more entertaining. Like I could sit back and it's just that mentality of this is what they're doing. I can't do anything about it. This is what I'm working with. Like what can I, how can I add to it? Or like, how can I make my experience better? So it's, it's fun.
What made you want to explore stand-up as another avenue from comedy?
I had this grand, this completely happened, totally unexpected. A couple years ago, I did a couple mics, and I just did one-liners, and I bombed horrifically. It was bad. Because, like, I mean, I love...
Is this in New York or here?
This is here, actually. Okay. And it was like, I'm never going to do that again. I was, like, super resistant to stand-up. I did a mic in Denver a couple years ago, and I bombed. I bombed, man. Like, one of my friends from... Like, I hit up one of my friends from grade school. I was like, I'm doing this mic. Like, it's going to be a lot of fun. And I saw him recording me and just kind of deflating with each bomb joke.
Oh, God.
I was like, oh, man. This is not going well.
Yeah.
And it dissuaded me from doing it. So I was like, you know what? You know, I'm going to stick with what I know, like characters and speaking or whatever. But earlier this year, I did this writing exercise where you take, like, one randomly chosen word by somebody else and you just riff on it. For 3 minutes, don't stop yourself, don't censor yourself, just kind of yes and every idea you have, and see where it leads you, see what connections you find. You know, it might be, you know, you might not come up with something the first couple minutes, but like towards the end, it was, so my word was milk, and
anyone who's ever seen David perform knows his word was
milk. That's all you need. Everyone knows David's word was milk, and I was like, oh, this isn't, you know, I don't know what I can do with this, you know, milk isn't really that funny, and...
Did someone just assign you the word?
Yeah. And so, no, it was like randomly picked.
Okay.
It was like out of a hat, words out of a hat.
Gotcha.
And at the very end, I just remember an experience I had. I ran into one of my parents' friends when I was growing up, and she was like, oh, you know, David, you look so much like your mom. You don't look anything like your dad. You must be the milkman's son. I thought, that's kind of a presumptuous thing to tell someone. Because what you're really saying is,
your mom, exactly.
And then I thought back, because that wasn't the first time it had happened. Like, I've been told that
a lot. Gets that
a
lot.
Yeah, I look a lot like my mom. I don't look anything like my dad. And so I got that a lot. And so I just took that idea and went with it. And it gave me the idea that, you know, with this one simple thing, like milk, to the lay observer, it's just milk. But if you really sit with any concept for long enough, you'll start to uncover layers to it. And the more you sit with it, the more you see, the more you uncover.
Oh, yeah. And well, I've been doing jokes for 2 years, and I'm still coming up with, like, new twists on punchlines for the jokes that are doing quite well. But I was like, oh, shit, you know what would be even funnier? I just had this with a joke last night that I've been telling for 2 years, so...
Isn't it crazy how it's just like a living, breathing organism? Yeah. Like, it's never done.
No, it's never done. No.
And even going back to the older gentleman who did not enjoy my presentation, like, I think that's what it is. It's like, we've been conditioned. Like, we go to school, we graduate from college, and then, like, that's it. We don't have to learn anything else. And so, you know, that resistance to saying, this is the way it is, and that's it. Like, when you can look at something as simple as milk and find... you know, jokes about your parents having an affair, and then, like, you know, what if the milkman was a stripper? Like, that was a stripper theme at a bachelorette party. It just kind of, it goes from there. And now I'm leaning into the fact that, like, that writing exercise was back in January, and it's July now.
Yeah.
And I'm still writing new jokes about
milk
when I don't want to. Last night at the
please
show.
Please stop. Yeah, you're like trying to control your hand.
My hand is just going.
Please just stop.
Yeah, I mean, if you peel back my wallpaper, it's just like scratches all over the wall.
Looks like a beautiful mind, but it has like pictures of cows and cheese and like 2% question mark.
Right, when humanity disappears, they're going to find my apartment and be like, what
it
is this?
It worships cows and math.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's funny to think about that way. And it really kind of goes in, like, the more I started writing about that, the more I started... You know, like, humans are the only animal to drink milk after infancy. Not only that, they're the animals that drink the milk of another animal.
Right.
So then I start exploring, like, all the other things humans do that are stubborn, and it kind of comes full circle. But what I really wanted to do with that was, like, write a half-hour sketch pilot where I kind of introduce the concept, sort of like a la Key and Peele, and then jump into, like, a couple, like, a video sketches. Like, I've written a song about it. It's just a matter of getting an ice cream truck and recording the video.
Holy shit.
Yeah. And I mean, I've written like other sketches. Like I have a man on the street planned where I'm just going door to door as a milkman, like see how people respond to it today. Because yeah, because
people would be like, "Ew, I don't want your milk."
Yeah, why?
That's gross.
The fuck?
We're calling the police. Get away.
Whose milk is that?
Yeah.
Gee, you'll appreciate this. I don't even know if you were there for this. Maybe you weren't. So two of my best friends went to your greenhouse show with me a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. The one I didn't perform at. And they also went to Couch Gags, and you had performed at that one that same week. And my friend Jess Ford was like, "Did you see that guy who went up there and completely stole that Indians dot joke?" And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And she was like, "There was a guy at your show the other night that told that joke, and there was a guy there tonight that stole it." And I was like, "That's the same person." What was really funny is that Jesse Studer, my other best friend, who's seen so many of these shows, like, because my friend Jess is black. She's like, "Oh, Jess, all those white men, they look the same to you." But she's like, "He's the same guy." She's like, "Are you sure? I almost heckled him." I'm like, "Well, I'm real glad you didn't, because that's his joke, so he didn't steal it." She's like, "Because I thought it was the funniest joke, and then I heard some guy up there telling that joke."
Oh, my God.
And that's so like, funny.
Yeah, so we made fun of her.
Yeah, no, I take on different personas.
Apparently, yeah. Well, you were wearing a beard last night's show.
So. Yeah. And
I would have thrown her way the hell off. She'd be like, "Who the hell's this?" Yeah.
He's doing milk jokes too.
Yeah.
You should do one of your stand-up sets. Just show up with like a fake milk mustache. Like
there you go.
Ad campaign.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just wear that the whole time.
Promote milk.
Yeah.
That'd be fun. That'd be fun. Because, I mean, I don't know. That's such a funny ad campaign to me. Just got milk and it worked.
It did. It worked. Really did. And everyone just had white mustaches.
Yeah. Which
Yeah, it was a lot of things going on there.
Right. But even last night, like I did a Fiddler on the Roof.
You did, yeah.
And when I went back and watched it, I completely forgot what Tevye, the main character, what he did for a living. Mm. He was the milkman.
Oh my God!
So as I'm writing this Fiddler on the Roof bit,
no.
And I see that, I put the pen down and I left my apartment. I went outside. I walked around for a little bit and I was like, I need.
It's like a milk curse.
It is. Well, I mean,
the table over.
You're like, when am I going to be lactose?
Yeah.
And lactose intolerant. Like, I haven't drank milk in a couple of years. And it's, I don't know. It's funny how that works. Like, and I even include this in the new bit. Like, I'm being driven mad by this thing. But it's like, you know, you buy a car. You didn't notice that car until you buy the car. And now you see it everywhere.
Ah, yes. I'm buying a car right now. Right. And now I've been researching like 10 cars.
Happens.
And they're everywhere
but
now.
But you didn't notice them before,
so
right?
So true.
Right.
I was literally, as you're talking, I leaned out the window to see what that car was. Because I was like, is this a car I've been looking at?
Yeah. That is your milk. Like, no. I mean, everybody has their own milk.
Yeah, which is a weird saying. Yeah. Let's not adapt that.
Some more than others.
Yeah, we'll put that on an inspirational poster with like a kitten.
No, but you run a show. Is there a schedule? I mean, is it every other Monday at Greenhouse?
Yeah, or? I mean, depending on my availability,
okay.
Too. I mean, I would love to get it to the point where, you know, other people run it. But
it's on the roof of Greenhouse Tavern, which is fantastic.
Is.
And you obviously, that's weather contingent.
It is. We have a backup spot. And,
do you?
And yeah, I mean, if you follow Greenhouse on social media, or if you follow me on social media, or if you follow, or if you like get a Facebook invite.
Yeah.
You know, we'll let you know. We'll make that call an hour before the show. But Society across the street has graciously opened its doors.
Is that the wintertime location, or have you figured out what you want to do for winter?
I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet. I mean, why I love that show is it's in such a heavy foot traffic area.
Yeah.
And, you know, every night, I mean, there's a lot of good comedians in Cleveland, which I didn't realize until I started going to mics. I'm like, holy shit, these people are great. If every night you're performing in front of the same audience, the same people who are also all comedians, like, you know, you don't get a real opportunity to work that stuff out in front of an audience that's there to laugh, an mm-hmm. audience that are non-comedians. And Greenhouse came to me with, you know, they said, would you do a comedy show on the roof? And I was like, I don't have time. Like, mm-hmm. I'm traveling a lot this summer. I would have to, you know, worry about tech and booking the show and all that. And they were like, oh, no, we'll cover you as far as tech.
That's
you know,
cool.
They were super supportive of
yeah.
it. So I was like, yeah, you know.
There are no spaces in town that's, like, I mean, Skidmark and I think Greenhouse are, like, the two most supportive spaces.
Oh, that's cool. Like, Skidmark does that.
Yes.
That's
well, awesome. I mean, Skidmark doesn't provide, like, tech and all that. But just from my experience having run shows at just bars,
mm-hmm.
And especially bars that don't have separate rooms where you can break off the comedy, they are not very inviting with comics. I mean, we're like the vermin of entertainment. Like, they would they would sooner have like screamo, like fucking mosh pit shit going on in there than they would have a comedian go up there for an hour.
I was at the last show at Avenue Tap House, and that's where we met.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I did the milk bit there. And
I was blown away, though, because usually when I meet people for the first time, especially Avenue Tap House, and have them go up, they're like, they're nervous and mm-hmm. they're okay. But I was like, no, he seems like he's been doing this a long time.
So. Well, the speaking definitely helps. You know, yeah. You get that you get comfortable on stage. And then that's another bonus of doing stand-up is that is that stage presence is translated
sure.
into my speaking.
100%.
Which is awesome. But no, we're running it. I want to do a show October 1st and do like...
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll warn you, this will probably come out in October, so...
Oh, really? Yeah. We have one the 10th and the 17th of September, and then October 1st, I really want to do just like a grand finale show.
With, okay,
like,
right on.
You know, the comics who've like, killed up on that stage, yeah, bring them all back and...
That's cool.
And do like a end of the summer kind of party on
that's
the
kind of a neat idea, though, to have a seasonal show where it's just strictly outside because then it doesn't get stale and then everyone gets excited for mm-hmm. when it's, you know, greenhouse season again and we go back to doing greenhouse shows. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of nice to have a seasonal thing.
Yeah, for sure.
To look forward to.
Yeah. Like I said, it's an opportunity, you know, for a lot of comedians to get to work their stuff out in front of an actual audience, which I love. But it also introduces the audience to the fact that Cleveland has a badass comedy
scene. Yeah, they do.
And not a lot of people know that. I was talking to somebody who was at the show last night and he saw on Greenhouse's social media that they were doing a show. And he's like, I'm really interested to see what Cleveland has to offer. And after the show, he was like, I'm coming back.
Good.
Yeah. And then we do a different lineup every show, too. I mean, you'll see, you know, some of the same faces come back because there are comedians who drop out.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's great that the scene is pretty supportive here. I found you know, people are willing to help. And if you have questions, like, I mean, that's all it is, you know. Just lean into what's happening and you know,
it's what you make of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're positive and you're, you know, people will be supportive, you know.
Yeah, at the very least, just accept an ad. Do that yes and.
Man. Yeah.
You can make a lot out of it.
Hell yeah. Where can people find you on social media?
Oh, man, I am the David Horning.
The David Horning.
Like the Ohio State University.
I
always thought that was funny. There are more David Hornings than I thought.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I was like, who are these people?
Have you met Anya Horning? She's another comedian here in Cleveland. Yeah, there's two Hornings.
I haven't met her personally yet, but she's coming on one of the shows.
Yeah.
And, I mean, with a last name like Horning, you should definitely look into doing comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've gotten that shit your whole life.
Yeah.
So, I'm looking forward to meeting her and, you know, like all the other comedians. You know, I would love to at least give them a stage, and if anybody ever wants feedback on anything, like I'm always ready and willing, and I'm always looking for feedback too. And
absolutely,
I think it's a great community. So yeah, the David Horning Instagram and Twitter, Snapchat. I think I'm just David Horning. I don't know. I do a lot of traveling, and I like to laugh at things that I don't normally see.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, there's so much out there, man. There's so much out there. Like when I go out of town, I'll have a day where there's like 20 snaps. it's too much.
Yeah, that's what Snapchat is for, because I don't want a million pictures I have to sift through. I just want to like have temporary snaps.
Yes,
exactly. So I understand it now. Gigi, where can we find you on social media?
You can find me on Instagram, ggchick, g.g.chick.
You can find me at epicfaul, epicfaul, on Instagram and Twitter. Thank you, Pete Milk, for doing our recording and production, and thank you, Above Below Entertainment, for being our network. David Horning, thank you so much for being on here today.
Pete's last name is Milk?
Pete Milk. Well, we won't
explain later.
Oh my God, he just realized that Pete's last name is also Milk. We used to call this place Milky Way Recordings.
I'm done.
David's jumping out the window right now, so we should probably...
Goodbye.
Okay, thank you. Wait. Okay, love you. Bye. There we go.